Let's start with Fading Civilizations by Paola Prestini.
Muse of an aged people, in the eve of fading civilizations, I was born of kindred that have greatly expiated and have greatly wept.
You're listening to the Indie Opera Podcast with Noah.
And Peter. Hey, guys.
Hey, guys.
We're going to have a podcast that we're going to just talk about Vox 2011 since it's coming up next weekend.
Next weekend, yeah.
And does everyone know what Vox is? What is Vox?
Vox is the Contemporary American Opera Lab, and it is, they call it the preview to the future of opera, and it truly is an exciting and kind of unique event in opera, and it's something special to New York, too.
Yeah, it's like a mulligatawny stew.
What is that?
Do you know what mulligatawny is? It's just a little of everything thrown in a big stew.
Oh, okay. You just throw it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. A mulligatawny stew. All right, maybe I'll have to edit that out.
No. Maybe someone will send us a recipe.
So this year it's happening, and I've mentioned this many times before, but it's happening May 14th and 15th. And this year they're actually doing it in two locations, which they don't normally do. They usually do one location. And what's special this year is that, May 14th is at the Skirball Center at part of NYU, which is right here on Washington Square. And then Sunday is at Le Poisson Rouge, which is this really hip bar / performance venue. What would you call it?
Those two cover it, but then also just it's even more than that, right? Because it's not. I mean, they do all sorts of things: new works, contemporary works, and
it's sort of a pop jazz. I mean, they'll have classical musicians doing their latest stuff. It's like a jazz club with classical, not even classical, sort of modern.
Yeah,
stuff.
You want to be there. You want to be at Le Poisson Rouge.
Yeah, I know. So the hot quartets and they're all playing there.
Also, on Saturday at 1 o'clock, there's going to be a panel discussion, and it's about producing art in alternate spaces, which we know a little bit about because Peter and I did a show outside. Peter's done an opera on an oil tanker in his history as a conductor.
Yeah, I mean, I think alternate spaces is a real sort of hot thing at the moment. And
yeah, I love those kind of spaces. Something cool about them, yeah.
So let's talk about Saturday, May 14th, and the operas that are there. Now
there are six operas going on. It starts at 2:30, and they're all excerpts. I don't think there are any complete works. Am I right on that?
Well, actually, the first one might be.
Really?
It's all three acts of a sad play performed entirely in bed by Dag Gabrielsson and Julie Larios. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a 10-minute opera, so if they excerpt it, there won't be...
One of those short opera shorts.
There won't be much left of it.
Right.
And I don't even want to read you what it's about necessarily, but it's all takes place in a single bed, and it's sort of a sex comedy. And I don't want to read it because that's basically the opera. It would take longer to read.
I know. I was amazed at how short some of the descriptions are of some of these operas. You know, they all kind of like catch your interest.
So that's the first one. The second one is
Faustine,
which is basically the Faust story on the female side, the woman's
side. Arlene Sierra is the composer, and Lucy Thurber. is the librettist.
And basically, it's, you know, the standard Faust story, but sort of inverted, with the woman selling her soul to become beautiful, selling her soul to the devil. And, you know, it's the basic story that you read in all the tabloids every day.
Right.
Well, sort of.
Kind of, yeah.
Except there is a real devil in that. And then the third piece, which I'm really interested in seeing, is Mary Shelley. And it's a story of Mary Shelley. The composer here is Alan Jaffe and librettist Deborah Atherton. And it's the story of the making of Frankenstein.
Right. It was a bad weather and boredom, right? Hanging out, Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley.
Yeah.
Right. They're hanging out with Lord Byron and smoking opium and they're bored. And here's the dare. Write a story. Write a scary story, you know?
And it's also about her inner life, and there's biography there. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, very cool.
And then this next one, I don't completely understand, but it's Dr. Sun Yat-sen. It's actually based on a true story from China. And I'm going to say these names wrong, I'm sure. Huang Ruo and Candace Chong. And the interesting thing about this is commissioned by Opera Hong Kong, and it's presented with China's National Center for the Performing Arts and Hong Kong's Leisure and Cultural Services Department. So it's got a lot of official backing from Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
kind of almost a diplomacy thing, right? A little I don't know. Yeah.
And it's marking the 100th anniversary of the Xinhai Revolution. And Dr. Sun Yat-sen is a folk hero and part of that revolution. And I can't wait to see this. I'm curious what it'll sound like. And
the last two works are ones that we're focusing on in this podcast more intensely, just because we have Royce Vavrick on as a guest this week.
And Royce is a librettist, and he was a librettist for something we actually saw together and spoke about in the last podcast, which was Prairie Dogs. Mm-hmm. And he's actually doing three of the operas this year. There's The Beach and Winkensport, which are the next two, which on the Saturday. But he's also doing Marin of Vardo on Sunday. So he's
a popular guy. He's a great writer, and he was really fun to have on.
So those
works are,
he gets to talk about those in the interview, so we'll let him
yeah, we'll let him do that. Yeah.
And then we have Sunday, which is going to be at Le Poisson Rouge, and these we actually also interviewed Hannah Lash, who's the composer of Blood Rose, which will be the first thing on Sunday. So if you hopefully will listen to our earlier podcast, but it was about
or go back and listen if you plan on going, you know, and hear her talk about her work. I always think that helps to understand or to listen to any music when you kind of know what a composer was going for.
And it's based on the Beauty and the Beast story, and listen to our last podcast to get more info on that. And then I am interviewing Paola Prestini about her opera, Dedeo, and also her career. And she's an amazing composer. Her librettist, Donna Di Novelli, have created a piece about the idea of the wheel, which was this mechanical thing where people would swap in their orphan babies and leave them at convents and things.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Medievalism going on. Yeah.
So it's the idea of the wheel, and she'll talk more about that in the interview. And then the other opera is Marin of Vardo. Now, Royce was also the librettist on this, and he doesn't mention it much in the interviewing coming up. So let's actually mention, talk a few seconds.
Well, we have a little clip, right? We do play a little clip of something from Marin. Isn't the duet from Marin of Vardo?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And it's, the music is incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. The story is basically, it's about Satan worship and a witch in the 17th century in Norway, a girl who is Marin of Vardo, who gets accused of being a witch.
Mm.
It's another classic tale.
And then we've got the Yoav Gal piece, right? 3 weeks.
And Yoav, I'm hoping to interview him this weekend and then get something up with his interview before Vox. He is doing an opera about the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. It's a religious work again. The last work that I saw of his was also on the idea of Moses, called Moshe. So that seems to be a theme here for him. His music's really incredible to hear in person. I can't wait to see what he's done. So that's our Vox chat.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, I think
we'll talk a lot more about it after.
Yeah, definitely. We'll have to. Also, if you go to Vox and you have something to say, you know, contact us. Get on our website. Get on our message boards. Send us a comment. And thanks for listening.
Great. And all so right. Now let's play the interview first with Paola, I want to say that the entire interview was delivered sotto voce because her child was asleep in the other room. Oh. So I feel like we're conspiring. We're all, you know, we're talking like this.
Whispering, yeah.
It was a really wonderful interview. So I've looked into your music. I've seen you've done an amazingly wide range of things. You've done film, you've done small pieces, big pieces. And your style seems to be very, very flexible. It seems that you like crossing borders a lot. Is that a goal of yours?
That's such a great question. I mean, I'm not sure if it's a goal, but it's something that just feels very natural to me. Having been raised on a border, I think those sensibilities kind of naturally emerged, and as I began to find my voice, which was naturally in song, it became a very natural part of my composition. It began with crossing the border of language and having dual language and different pieces, and then it became, when I started my company, crossing disciplines.
What's the name of your company?
So the name of my company is called Vision Into Art. Okay. And I started it in 1999 when I was a student at the Juilliard School, really with the intent of creating new music collaborations and collaborative opportunities for composers. At the time, there wasn't a lot of collaboration happening at Juilliard. I think it's radically different now, but at the time it seemed that we really needed a company that devoted itself to commissioning composers. So as the needs of our ecosystem here in New York changed, the company became more about really just commissioning specific pieces instead of being a collective, which is how it started.
So do you feel that the environment now has changed?
I think it's just a wonderful place to be active. I think it's a community that really supports itself. It's a community that is working very fluidly across disciplines. And so inevitably things change. And I think, you know, any kind of model of any company needs to be fluid and needs to be able to change with our time. So, but that's actually how I came into composing across disciplines, was really because I founded this company, because I needed a place to be able to experiment and to explore.
And you're not only just crossing musical and artistic boundaries, you're physically crossing boundaries. I saw that you had a program that took place in Mexico.
Yes. Actually, in 2011, this year, in January, I co-founded a lab in a small town near Mexico City called Tepoztlán. And I co-founded it with a writer, and it's a laboratory that really is about bridging Mexican and American cultures through song. And we invite singers and composers and writers to come and create in this very magical setting.
Is it intended to be a yearly thing? Or?
It is a yearly thing, and it's actually sponsored by the Mexican government.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to continue in 2012, and we're opening up submissions soon and choosing our faculty right now.
And is it something that students apply for, or is it a grant?
It is, in fact, going to be something that students apply for, but we will have a number of grants for students. It is going to be largely subsidized. And the intent is really to create a place where, you know, where students who have never created opera can come and learn from people who are really in the trenches creating opera now.
Great. And it seems that the other boundaries you cross are into film. There's a lot of film on your resume, and also, but also music that actually was composed with film in mind, like The Body Map.
Yes, Body Maps, absolutely. So, I mean, I've definitely been a film composer this year. I was a Sundance Fellow and was really excited to be scoring some fantastic documentaries. But a lot of the work I've done in my company is really about commissioning artists who are, I feel, at the same level of the compositional quality. And so one of my biggest passions was finding visual artists and filmmakers who would want to collaborate with composers. And Body Maps was actually a collaboration with a Mexican artist named Erika Harsh. And we created this work of visual art and film side by side.
So you did it, it wasn't consecutive, you didn't say, here's the music, create the imagery.
No, it was really fluid. It was a process of back and forth and back and forth until we had the product.
And it's based on a folk story inspiration?
No, or? Body Maps is actually quite abstract. It really deals with different body parts, different women's body parts, and the myths that define us. So it just became a very simple, in a sense, structurally simple tale that dealt with eyes, hands, feet, and how these different body parts have experienced different different adventures, different emotions, different journeys. And so we attached that to different paintings that then became animated. Yeah. And it's structurally balanced by a choir of voices and a choir of cellos. And the cellist is my husband, Jeffrey Ziegler, who's the cellist of the Kronos Quartet. And the choir of voices was made of Hila Pleetman, who's a wonderful, wonderful coloratura soprano.
The other film that I saw, it looked like it was in Iraq, a table. It looked like people hiding under a table.
Yes, so that's a filmmaker that is much more kind of a Hollywood filmmaker that I work with, and his name is Chase Palmer, and he's an extraordinary filmmaker. That film that you're talking about is called Shock and Awe, and it won many different film festivals, Austin Short Film Festival. What was interesting about that piece was that, yes, in fact, it was about a family who's hiding underneath a table in the aftermath of war, and he actually cut that whole film to my music. Wow. So it was a really extraordinary experience, because I was going into it thinking, oh, I'm going to have this Hollywood experience, and then totally didn't.
It's the opposite.
Yeah.
Because usually in a film, the music's last.
It's... Exactly. So I was actually kind of shocked, but it was a pleasant shock.
Now, these films seem to be political. Do you consider yourself a political artist?
No, I just consider myself a product of our time. I mean, as composers, I think in every century and in every time, we're meant to really be voicing the spirit of our time, and we're in a highly political, energized moment, and I think it's impossible not to be inspired by, you know, sociopolitical themes. I happen to be really invested in, you know, in political themes, in education, in a very democratic way of looking at collaboration. So it probably just emerges naturally. what interests me, what I'm gravitating towards.
So the project that's going to be at Vox this year, Dedeo. Tell me a little bit about that.
So Dedeo is a work written by a wonderful writer named Donna Di Novelli. Donna is a very seasoned writer who is creating a work right now called Heart of a Soldier for San Francisco Opera. And she approached me last year after Vox last year. I had a piece on it called Oceanic Verses, and it responded to her. It really, you know, it was something that really, I think, attracted her. And so she came to me with this idea of creating a work based on the medieval construct of the wheel that was built into churches and outside Catholic churches as a deposit where women would leave their children. And she was fascinated with this idea. And for me, it seemed really compelling. But in general, I'm only attracted to contemporary themes. And so the conversation became, yes, I love the idea, but how can we make this contemporary? And what was wonderful about Donna was that she really allowed me into the process, and so it became a real conversation, and we finally fell upon the idea of the wheel as a mechanism that can move us forward and backwards in time.
So is there a structural plot that goes all the way through?
Yes, so it actually begins with a young man from Brooklyn who is on an identity search. and he is a product of the wheel in contemporary time. And when he goes to discover, when he return, he goes to Italy to discover his past and to try to create some kind of a, you know, of an understanding of where he's from, he falls upon the construct of the wheel, and the wheel takes him back in time to actually to a thousands of stories of foundlings, and it becomes this beautiful kind of multiplied counterpoint of stories and lives that have been affected by this wheel.
So when you're looking at a new project, what are the sort of things that attract you? Is it the people you'll be working with? Is it the subject matter? Let's say, what attracted you to Dedeo?
Simply Donna. I mean, I loved her writing, and I loved that, you know, I had never actually worked with a librettist. All the works that I had done were actually with writers that weren't alive. So to me, what attracts me is the ability to learn something new, to have a new experience that's going to allow me to grow as an artist. And so I knew immediately upon meeting her that I would have this unbelievable opportunity to grow. And also, I had had an experience in Fox the year prior where they had accepted my work, and the work I had created was definitely very, very unoperatic in many ways. And so I was very excited by the ability to embark on a new work for Vox that would really kind of allow me to delve into a different operatic scope. And I should say that it's part of the Word First program, so it was kind of almost in residence. So we knew that it would be developed as part of Vox when we started.
So your process, do you find, are you a very meticulous, slow process, or does it sort of flow right out of you?
It starts very slow, so the process of talking and, you know, studying and listening happens over the course of many months, and it needs to kind of slowly sink in. But when I'm actually creating, it's a very fast process.
So how do you think harmonically? Do you just hear it in your head, or is it something that you, do you play it at the piano?
Work at the piano, and I think very contrapuntally. So every line that I create ends up creating veins and roots upwards and downwards in terms of harmony.
And are you working in full score, or are you working on the piano and then flesh it out?
I tend to work at a piano score and then flesh it out. But I do definitely think contrapuntally, so there's definitely always lines and harmony. And the thing about this experience with Dedeo is that it's for string quartet. So it was a very, I actually just wrote it for string quartet. I didn't actually have a piano score. But when I write larger scale works, I definitely start with a piano score and orchestrate.
And do you run things by your husband? Do you say, will this work? Can you play three notes on the cello at the same time?
He is my harshest critic. I absolutely run things by him, and we always fight and like ends up, you know, creating a nice big rift for like a day, and then we get over it. But he's wonderful. He has a wonderful aesthetic sense, and obviously is a great string player, so I run all my string writing by him. And you know, it's very important to have someone you trust who you can also get angry at when they tell you the truth. A voice that I absolutely respect. I don't always take what he says, but I can take it and understand where it's coming from. And many times he's very pointed, you know, very pointedly on. I think what he has is that he listens to so much music and plays such a wide variety of music that he generally has a reason, you know, for saying things, and he has a very intuitive, quick response because of the amount of music he plays.
And the piece, the Dedeo, who's going to be playing the quartet?
So we just learned tonight that it's all the principal players of the orchestra.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so, which is a nice relief. Although the whole orchestra is great, so it would have been fine either way. But it's nice to know that they assigned it that way.
And how much rehearsal do you get with them before?
Not very much. Actually, tonight was interesting because we were talking with our vocal coaches, and my piece includes a lot of electronics. It has a lot of processed mouth sounds, and the idea is to really kind of incorporate a contemporary language into this time-crossing story, so that the electronics and the manipulation of the voice becomes the common thread.
And is that done live, or is that recorded?
It's all me recorded, processed.
So a lot of it's actually done before the
all
live.
All of it. Yeah, actually, sorry, that's your question. It's not live. It's all pre-recorded backing tracks that are done from real sounds.
Not the vocal part, but will they'll be playing live?
So they'll be playing live, and sections will be on click with pre-recorded backing tracks that are made of all composite of sounds. And I tend to take my recorder with me everywhere, so there's also field recordings, and it's a real the funny thing was that Dawn and I met with our vocal coach, and she just, you know, she hadn't had a lot of experience with working with electronics, and she just told me, she's like, I'm an acoustic coach. And I just want to let you know that I'm an acoustic coach. And I was like, well, don't worry. I said, this is actually just like an instrument. You have to understand the electronics are just like another arm. And I think what I love about Vox and the program is really just that it's an opportunity for everybody to grow. And the fact that they're now expanding into spaces like Le Poisson Rouge is really great, because it gives us the opportunity to work with electronics in a fluid sense.
That's very exciting. I can't wait to go. So do you have any future projects? What's up next?
What's up next is I'm finishing Oceanic Verses for a premiere at the Kennedy Center next summer, and then we're bringing it to Winter Garden as part of the River to River Festival 2012. And then I run a series called 21C Lieder Abend with Beth Morrison. And our companies, along with a third company, we co-produce this quite expansive survey of song. And so we're touring it to the West Coast and now planning our 2013 New York Lieder Abend. And it's a wonderful opportunity for me as a composer to really dig my hands deep into producing works that I admire. Wow. So I feel very lucky to be able to be part of that. So that's it will also feature my own work, but equally be presenting many wonderful composers. And then also creating several other works. I'm working on a work called Aging Magician with Rendy Eckert, and another work called Ioanni about the Cuban blogger with Royce Vavrick. And so, yeah, I have my hands in a couple different projects, which is really exciting because each of them explores a very different approach to composition, which I think is really necessary.
Well, I feel very lucky that you took some time out to talk with me.
Thank you. It's a joy, and I very much appreciate your interviewing me.
Well, thank you.
I hope we work together soon.
Sure.
Now we're going to listen to a conversation that we had with Royce Vavrick, a librettist who is highly in demand at this moment.
And let's actually listen to a little bit of his stuff, and then we'll follow that with the interview.
All right.
Hey, Royce.
Hi.
How are you?
It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
We wanted to talk to you today a little bit about some of your work that you did. We saw Prairie Dogs. We saw your work at Ladies' Night, and you actually answered a question that we've had between ourselves. Can opera be funny?
Yeah, we had this kind of totally unrelated conversation about couple days before we saw this, and we were just talking about, is opera ever really genuinely funny? People cite the comedies, Meistersinger, is it actually funny? You know?
Well, yeah, I've been to operas where the funniness is more like, oh, ha ha ha, funny.
And yeah.
And not truly sort of Saturday Night Live funny, which Prairie Dogs was, or at least for me.
Yeah, I thought it was really funny. Like, it was gut funny.
Gut funny. That particular project, was that someone approach you with the idea of the project, or were you the genesis?
Rachel and I had written the 20-minute opera Mermaid in the Jar that was based on a short story by Sheila Hedy, and it was ridiculously, deliciously funny. And so going forward, trying to find a way to make a full-length piece, we chose to have the conceit of this girl, this 11-year-old girl, who finds herself in very weird, strange, crazy circumstances within her bedroom in a bungalow. And so Prairie Dogs was an original piece. I had always wanted to, or in the past few years, I had been thinking a lot about this Gopher Hole Museum and how I wanted to write a piece that maybe took place inside the museum, maybe just in somehow was informed by this these maquettes and these strange scenes that were tableaus that were being created out of these carcasses, these taxidermy carcasses. And so we, in designing a second part of this planned three-part triptych, I sort of just let it, my imagination, go wild and crazy, and we came up with this strange Prairie Dogs piece.
And there's going to be a third?
Part? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, we have not started writing it. We had an idea about a year ago that we've sort of abandoned, and now we have another idea that we're really excited about, and we're really gung-ho about finishing the whole work so that we can get some real development going. And
where is the actual Gopher Museum?
The Gopher Hole Museum is in Torrington, Alberta.
Okay.
And I've never been. But there is an amazing YouTube that you both should see where it sort of takes you through each of the maquettes and the dioramas and has really fun music. And
so let's we'll put that on the website.
Definitely. So is it in good shape? I always wonder about the taxidermy museums because everyone I've been to, they always seem like they look really bad and kind of rotten.
I guess this sort of leads into the question of choice of subject for an opera or a film.
I am not working in film very often anymore. But that being said, one of my next projects I'm designing is I want to commission 4 short operas that are intended to be filmed. So I will write the libretti as screenplays and then we'll commission 4 composers, and then we will film and exhibit them as pieces of cinema as opposed to pieces of opera or theater, necessarily.
Ah, and 4 different composers.
I believe so. That's where my brain is going these days. I'm in love with too many composers to just choose one at the start. I like to think big and wild.
So yeah. The it seems that a lot of the, like, we're sort of doing this as an introduction to Vox 2011. It seems like there's certain categories that operas can fall into. So there's sort of this documentary element that's going on. And one of the operas that you do, The Beach, is it a documentary style or what would you call it?
I would call it, it's fictional. It is inspired by recent events. And it is a narrative operatic fiction.
Mm. Let's give a little synopsis of what is it about.
So the piece is about a 40-year-old woman, and we've given her the name Adele, who marries an 80-year-old man named William. And at the top of the opera, we find out that William's childhood friend comes knocking, and we understand that there's something going wrong, and William is not where he should be. And through the course of the opera, we understand that William is locked away in a laundry room, being fed stale pastries, and slowly slipping into dementia.
So is he experiencing memories, or is he experiencing...
He is, yeah. The title, The Beach, comes from this idea that Adele sort of encourages him to imagine being at the beach, which is one of his favorite places to go and relax and vacation and all these things. And the beach is very important to him and his childhood memory, so she encourages him to go back there to comfort him, even though she's forcing him into this really insane, crazy, wild, which is really...
the idea is wild, but this is inspired by events that happened in France?
Yeah, that happened this summer even. I cannot believe that we managed to get this 25-minute sample completed. Andrew and I he forwarded me the article off of Reuters or something.
Let's actually make it clear who Andrew is.
Andrew Gerla, the composer of The Beach. And so Andrew found this article and he emailed it to me and said that this would make a great opera and that we should just bite the bullet. And so we wrote the 25 minutes that everybody will be hearing at Vox in about a month and a half. He orchestrated as he went. and managed to get it all done in about a month and a little
bit. Wow.
And recorded. We did demos at the end of that too, which is
it
crazier.
A big orchestra, small? What do we?
That's a about? That's a full all nasty out. Orchestra, all out orchestra. Yeah,
excellent.
I have two of those pieces. I have two that are going to be full orchestra, and then Bardo is the on the second night, which is just a chamber outfit.
Mm-hmm. And the other piece that you're associated with is Winkensport.
It's
or sport.
It's Winkensport. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And that's about?
Winkensport is about the Flemish folk sport of finch sitting.
Finch?
Finch sitting.
Okay.
Yeah. Finch sitting.
And that's not sitting on a bird or anything, right?
No, it's sitting sort of in the vicinity of a bird.
Uh-huh.
So it's written for six principals. And it was commissioned by Don Upshaw at the Bard Conservatory. Oh, and wow. We did a full production of it there February of 2010. And it's a true sport where people train finches, little chaffinch finches, and they gather and put their boxes with their birds in a certain distance away that actually encourages them to sing. And they, over the course of an hour, they try to coax out as many songs, suskowits. And they each, in real life, they all tally the tweets of a different competitor's bird. In our version, they tally their own birds' tweets.
It's old-fashioned tweeting.
It's old-fashioned tweeting.
So how do they elicit songs from the birds?
Oh, well, it's crazy because it's been around for hundreds of years. And often, because only the male finches sing, there have been cases of testosterone being injected, which is actually one of the...
bird steroids.
And so we were sort of tasked with writing a piece for... six singers, and then having each of them have really substantial moments. So really exciting that we get to, we're going to do, I think, three or four arias, big song moments, which I know many people are very hungry for in contemporary opera.
So when you're writing for opera, when you're choosing your words, are you considering the vowel harmonies of how a singer may sing them, or are you just thinking more in a dramatic structural way?
All of the above. I sort of relish in the crunchiness of words, too. So, yes, I do make sure to take into consideration the sounds of words, but also that can be both beautiful and ugly, and I like...
Do you write differently for play writing than you would for an opera?
I have written... I'm writing so much opera these days and not much playwriting or musical theater or anything. I would say that 95% of my work is for the opera, which great. I'm so happy to reside in this.
Did you expect that to happen? Or is
no, 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 no. I'm a farm boy. I grew up in a small town in northern Alberta, Canada, and I don't necessarily know what I wanted to be. There was a time when I was a child I wanted to be a pharmacist, and
wow.
But I was a trained boy soprano, and then took singing lessons all through high school. When
oh,
my
so
voice
you're
changed.
A singer. That's important to know.
That stopped the second I left Grand Prairie and moved to Montreal. So I am in no way in good voice these
Are
days.
You an opera listener?
It's brand new to me, really. Mm. I'm a huge film buff. I love seeing straight plays and musicals on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Opera has always been... I knew that it was something that I would love to discover, but it never really was something that I had access to as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Was there a singular event that sort of woke you up to opera?
Yeah, I remember my singing teacher, Ellen Otterson, who is just one of the most important people in my entire life. She encouraged me to get a recording of the Pagliacci, and that was sort of my introduction. And I also bought a recording of Zalome, I think Jesse Norman singing Zalome, and those were my two intros.
That's a good pair.
And I got the Pavarotti recording of the Pagliacci, so I guess Pavarotti and Jesse Norman were my ins.
There's two big voices to lead you in. And so now... Do you have a lot of projects in the pipeline? Or?
Oh my God, I am very busy.
Yeah, I was going to say one of the things we were really excited about having you on was I just keep seeing your name
all over the place, you know, in programs and things. So
I am so excited by the opportunities that have come my way and the people that I get to collaborate with. The three gentlemen that I am presenting work with at Vox are three very, very important collaborators to me. David T. Little is absolutely... He has changed my life in many ways. He and I did Dog Days at last year's Vox. Were you guys at?
I was at Dog Days. I saw Dog Days. Yeah, I was there last year.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah, I liked it, yeah.
And so that David actually received a commission from Carnegie Hall to write the first 20 minutes of Dog Days. Mm. And it was right after I had done the American Lyric Theater Composer Librettist Training Program, which I credit with 99% of my abilities. And Larry Edelson there is absolutely ridiculously awesome. And
did you look at the work of other librettists? Did you look at like De Ponte? Did you look at Hoffmannsthal? Or
no.
I think that's cool. It's cool either way, you know.
Now I have done a little bit of the work, and I keep acquiring more and more operas as days go by. But I am so brand new, and I know that it's sort of ignorant, but I'm slowly trying to become more and more informed as to what has gone on before me. I had the amazing opportunity of sitting in on rehearsals of City Opera's Vanessa back a few years ago and being able to slowly uncover that piece and learn what Menotti and Barber did together was that may be the one piece that is most important to me, just because I feel like I know that opera like none other.
Are there pieces right now that you're listening to that sort of inspire you?
I love Marc Adamo's work. He is one of my mentors, and seeing Little Women and beginning to understand the intricacies of that score and libretto
it's a great piece.
And who wrote the libretto for that?
Adamo wrote both.
Oh, okay, he did both. Okay.
Words. Yeah. I love Marc Adamo.
Do you generally, when you decide to work with a composer, do you feel like you want to tailor your words to their music, or do you feel like you want somebody who has a kind of complete musical way of composing and then you can just hand them words and see them change?
I listen to a lot of their work and try to understand as much as possible. I work with so many wildly different composers, and I'm sort of a chameleon, and I pride myself on the ability of not altering my words. I think that you can see a Royce Vavrek text, whether it's a lyric or a full libretto, and you can definitely see traces of me in everything. For instance, I am completing the libretto of Missy Mazzoli's Song from the Uproar, and which was at Vox in 2010. And it's a very stylized, the text that she put in prior to my coming on. And so I sort of have to match that, or I don't want it to be, I don't want it to stick out. I don't want them to draw attention to themselves because they're
overwhelming,
different.
Overwhelming, yeah.
But I want to offer her, she hired me to write words, so I want to give her the things that make my word special.
Mm-hmm. What is that particular stamp that says it's a Royce Vavrek lyric?
Well, interesting that I just said Missy. I referenced Missy's text because I think that's quite different from what I normally do and what I gravitate towards. I think that my stuff is always a little quirky. Mm-hmm. I have a desire to contribute somewhat comedic works, even though Dog Days, for instance, is not... it's a dark, dark, dark comedy, but there are still those quirky moments of comedy that just leap out. Vinkensport, on the other hand, is... It has
That's
moments
gotta
that
be
are...
Quirk.
Yeah. have you heard any of the samples on... So, Vinkensport has, like, one character who just progressively gets more and more drunk. And she... you find out that she has a tendency to get so inebriated that she loses clothes. And she was making out with an 85-year-old man at the last community thing. And
let's actually listen to that.
Yeah.
If you finch sit with the locals, we'll go away next week. My husband likes to bribe me. He knows I'll do practically anything with a dirty vodka martini.
teetering on stilettos, I know when to sing. When I'm emotional, I'm emotional, I'm emotional.
I'm amazed that I can still, even over Skype, hear every word.
Oh, good.
I mean, it's, you know, it's that's such a common criticism of opera in English that you go and it's like, this is in English? But this is so clear.
She had beautiful diction.
Yeah, but yeah. I don't know. I can't help but think it's the libretto somewhat, too. I mean, maybe, what's your secret? Is it rhythm? Is it, how do you do that?
You know, it was also a hallmark of the Prairie Dogs we saw.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that the word setting was very smart. I mean, that has a lot to do with the composer.
Very easy, yeah.
David Little and Rachel Peters are two very exemplary examples of musical dramatists. They take my words and they really author the drama through their music, which not every composer has that skill or that desire, mm-hmm. necessarily. And they just are super marvelous at really trying to create a musical work of drama.
They seem to clear the sound out, though, at the right time, so they're not obliterating the consonants as well. It sounds like that their structure really sort of holds up the singer without wiping them out.
And David said that he was very conscious about the orchestra and sort of getting out of the way of the singers in Big and Sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes it's the art of not doing. That's half the fun of the composing. Is there another thing we should listen to?
Yeah.
Let's listen to something else.
Well, why don't we listen to Evening Furnace, Evening Beauty, which is a sample from Mira Novato. And this is the absolutely beautiful Morgan James singing Armerin and Christopher Burchett.
And this is Jeff Myers' music, right?
This is Jeff Myers' music. Mm.
All right, let's listen. Okay, so this is a very different... It's sort of the other side of Royce.
Yeah.
It seems that, you know, the first one was very active. There's a lot of dynamic stuff. This feels like a set. This feels like an aria.
Yeah.
A moment of setting still. What was your goal when you were writing this?
I actually wrote six lines, and Jeff came to the moment and said, I think that this could be a duet. And so he took those two gestures, those two verses, essentially, and then right after that, they come together and they sing their sections on top of each other in a really, really beautiful way. So he... That was Jeff's decision.
Did you expect to write more? And then he kind of said, no, that's enough?
I don't know that I expected it to be a huge musical moment. I just wrote a very small amount of text, and he decided that it warranted a very big moment, a very tender moment.
When you're working with a composer, is there a lot of back and forth like that, where you say, are you working sort of through the piece with them, or do you ever just offer them, this is the libretto, and they go off and do their own thing?
Very rarely. I sort of pride myself and my collaborators on being collaborative. And so I'm also not very precious with my words, in the sense that I will write a draft, will send it, will get feedback, and have no problems tearing things apart, putting them back together, making it really exciting for the composer. Because my job, I believe, is to write the text that is going to excite the composer to write the best music that they possibly can. If what I have given them is in some way not allowing or not getting their juices flowing, then I think that I can do better.
Oh, that's great. Maybe we should do one more.
Yeah.
Maybe the Prairie Dogs again.
Let's do it. What, arts and crafts?
Is actually a good segue. One of my muses, I pretty much write everything for this woman. And we have a downtown opera company called the Coterie together. Her name is Lauren Warsham, and she plays the girl in this version. And Carla Faggard plays Watermelon. And this is actually done at our Coterie concert in December. But Lauren is... She has one of those hybrid voices that she actually sang Lisa in our Dog Days reading at Box last year. And she recently was in Where's Charlie at New York City Center Encores. And she does a lot of musical theater, but she has this pretty crazy legit voice that really, really excites me. So
let's give it a listen.
Yeah.
Never seen an opera that has worked in that way?
I've laughed, but I've noticed that the laughing isn't really about what they're saying. It's a pratfall, or it's, you know what I mean? Mozart is very funny. The whole scene, they're in the closet, and it's funny, but situationally funny.
And it's not, it's still, at least maybe you disagree, Peter, it's just not ha-ha funny, you know? And it's kind of annoying sometimes when people affect laughter at it, because it's like, I don't know.
But we also, we go to the opera and we see these very antiquated museum-like works. Right. And so perhaps allowing an audience to come in and see a contemporary version of themselves or of their world.
But it also takes a certain amount of bravery, really, because, you know, a lot of young writers, they want to write the opera. It's very serious. They want to be taken seriously. I don't think you get as much...
Right, the masterpiece or whatever.
Yeah, it takes a certain amount of bravery to write something that's really, you know, that uses the word homo, to be totally honest.
And yet, at the same time, it's not funny like Saturday Night Live. I mean, there's a lot of substance and there's a kind of wistful quality to that, what's going on in that scene. And
I'm glad to hear that you both appreciate it.
Well, I guess this is a good place to end.
Yeah, thank you so much, Royce. It was really a joy to have you on.
It's been a pleasure, my goodness. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, thanks for listening to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is goodbye from me, Noah.
And Peter. And thanks for listening. Maybe we'll see you at Vox this year. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.